Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I am Michael Nacht, Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and your moderator for the program. This program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East and Asia-Pacific forums. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Dr. Vali Nasser, Dean of the Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and author of the new book, The Dispensable Nation, America's Foreign Policy in Retreat. Dr. Nasser has had a very distinguished career. He's the author of several important books, including The Shia Awakening. He has a PhD in political science from MIT, and most recently he served for 2 years as the special advisor to Richard Holbrooke, who was the president's special advisor for Afghanistan and Pakistan. You're in for a treat with this program. Reminder for the radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Vali Nasser. And now I would like to turn the floor over to Dr. Nasser for his remarks.
Good evening. Thank you, Dr. Nacht, for that introduction. And I'm very grateful to be back here at the Commonwealth Club. Talking about the title of this book, about American foreign policy in retreat, when I was writing it, it was more difficult to think of how foreign policy would fit into our national discussion, given that for the past 4 years, we operated on the assumption that generally we didn't need to focus on it and that there were no real important issues that mattered. And now, actually, we're seeing a large numbers of crises emerging around the world that require attention, and therefore it's important to think about where we are and how we should think about foreign policy. Let me take you back to sort of a personal observation which jump-started the thinking about this issue. Back to 2009, I had just recently started working with Ambassador Holbrooke on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Then the issue was the single most important foreign policy issue facing the new administration. The president had campaigned against the war in Iraq, had seen the war in Afghanistan as the good war, as the right war, as a war of necessity, and was determined to finish that war in an appropriate way. And the question was how to do that. And but very early in this discussion, it was clear that even though the president had wanted to break with the Bush period and to chart a new course for American foreign policy, by and large, we were really buying into the Bush administration's policy about Iraq. And the reason for that was that in Iraq, the military was seen as having saved the day. It was a war that the civilians caused, and the military was able to conclude. The surge was seen as a triumphant outcome to the Iraq war. And the new president, despite his popularity, very quickly found out that the domestic political imperative really didn't let him to show too much daylight between himself and the counterinsurgency strategy that had been deployed in Iraq. So despite all disclaimer to the contrary, we began to gradually adopt that strategy. The president had hardly been in office that he ordered new troops to go to Afghanistan, made a commitment that the United States would defeat the Taliban, that we would win that war, we would put the Taliban on its back heel, and we would put our shoulder to building a prosperous democratic state in Afghanistan. So in September 2009, usually there's a two-week period, which is the meetings of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. And many world leaders come to these meetings, and largely they come in order to have side meetings. I mean, hardly anybody goes to the actual speeches at the United Nations. I like to think of it as kind of like the diplomatic version of speed dating. You go to meeting to meeting to meeting. And our mission was basically to begin to sound out allies and interested countries in a new American strategy in Afghanistan, and then to begin to sell them on that. And the message was very simple, which is we're committed to winning in Afghanistan, and we're going to do so by putting more troops on the ground in Afghanistan. And we didn't call it that, but basically we're going to take General Petraeus's search strategy in Iraq and export it to Afghanistan. I remember very distinctly, and it was only very recently I had joined in, that every meeting I went with Ambassador Holbrooke, and he really didn't believe in this strategy. But as a good soldier, it was his job to market the administration's strategy and then, get feedback and take it back to the White House, that we would get these incredulous looks on people's faces. Nobody said, great, good news, we were waiting for you to do this. Everybody sort of politely acknowledged. And then I remember going to a meeting with an Arab foreign minister who, after hearing us out, basically said, this is a mistake. Let me give you an advice. You want to deal with terrorism. This is why you started this. Why don't you just give money to the warlords in Afghanistan to get rid of the terrorists? They're a lot better at it than you are, and it's going to cost you a lot less. He said, I figure it will cost you $20 billion. Just go home. Don't try this, because if you try it, you will fail. And if you fail, it's bad for you, and it's bad for us. Well, this wasn't quite, the message that we were hoping to get. And I remember going to a next meeting, and you can't make this up, but in reality that was the case. This it was another Arab foreign minister who basically said the same thing. He actually said, you should be working with the Taliban because they are opposed to Iran. You're opposed to Iran. They're your best friends. Why are you fighting them? And you should give money to the warlords and let them take care of this problem. And you don't need to do all of this troop surge and nation building and all of this. Except he said it's going to cost you a lot less. He said $1 billion. What we came out was that, nobody was buying our strategy. Nobody believed it would work. Nobody wanted us to try it. And, you had one set of conversations in the United States, which was very heavy on this idea of a surge, and another set that was largely that people didn't want us to do another Iraq. Not because they just were tired of war, because they were convinced we would fail. In fact, it was our closest friends and allies who didn't want us to do that. But they also said something else to us. Invariably, every one of them said, there is a diplomatic path to finishing this thing. It's why don't you try a negotiated end to this war? Instead of surging, instead of trying this, why don't you explore whether it's possible to get the neighborhood together and create a forum in which you can have a negotiated settlement between the Taliban and the Karzai government to end this. We knew, Ambassador Holbrooke knew directly from Karzai's mouth that he wanted it. Norwegians, the British, the Germans, the Saudis, the Turks, the Pakistanis, everybody told us it is possible to do negotiations. Well, after we came back was the period when President Obama did what is called the strategic review for Afghanistan, which means that he and his National Security Cabinet spent something close to 30 hours, and in his case, 10 meetings and 30 hours, but the rest of the cabinet met independently many more hours to look at options for Afghanistan. And if you read accounts of that period, and probably one of the most copious ones is Bob Woodward's book. You see, there were only two options on the table, what is called a fully resourced counterinsurgency, which is essentially the Iraq model. And the other one, which was kind of a straw man put up there by Vice President Biden, was that we would just leave Afghanistan and use drones and special forces to hit targets from the air. What is surprising is that there was no diplomatic option considered by the president. And that diplomatic option's champion was Richard Holbrooke. He basically he didn't need to be told by these Arab foreign ministers that surge is a bad idea. He remembered Vietnam. He thought if you surge and it doesn't work, you have to surge more and you have to surge more. And then you end up in Vietnam. He said it's much better not to surge, because he used to say if you surge, you withdraw faster. Surging is like sprinting. You put 130,000 troops and then put money for agriculture, all sorts of things on the ground at a cost of $100 billion a year, you'll withdraw faster because you can't maintain that. And nobody believes that you can maintain that. Your strategy has no credibility. His advice was think of a strategy that you put a lot fewer troops on the ground, but everybody in the region, including the Taliban, could see that as a credible, sustained U.S. presence. And then use that to craft a diplomatic strategy. But the president did not consider that strategy. And it wasn't that the strategy was good or bad or whether it would have worked or not. The main point is that it was never considered. Why wasn't it considered? Because it was politically, domestically, politically risky to consider talking to the Taliban. It was politically safe to embrace the Bush administration's policy. So the Obama administration basically started from the premise in Afghanistan of essentially accepting the Bush administration policy, even though the president himself did not believe in it. And then the president immediately put a limit on the surge, saying it's good for a year. After that, we're withdrawing. And then within a year, he basically said that we are withdrawing and we'll be gone by 2014. So I remember a year later going back to the region to those same countries we had gone and told them, believe us, we're going to stand behind our strategy. We're going to see this fight to the end. So we went to them and said, we believe we've defeated the Taliban and we're going home. So, you know, that nobody in the region believes the Taliban have been defeated. Maybe only in this country we believe that. Nobody in the region believes they've been defeated. So their answer was that we knew this was going to fail. We told you so. And we knew you're not going to stand behind this strategy. So what do you want to do? And we said, we're going to create this Afghan military, 400,000-man Afghan military. Since then, the number's been brought down to 230,000. And they're going to do what we couldn't do. Nobody believed that either. And in fact, the bet in the region became whether the military we're building in Afghanistan will collapse faster than the one the Soviet Union built. And theirs collapsed 60 days after they stopped paying the checks, exactly 60 days after they paid the checks. And I remember the one Pakistani general said, you know, we didn't believe you will stay. We didn't believe your strategy will work. But just if you want to leave, just leave. Just don't make any more trouble on your way out. Don't try to build an Afghan army, because all you're going to do is to teach these people to shoot straighter, and they're going to break into militias. That's going to be a headache for the region. Now, you know, we have a narrative domestically, which is Afghanistan good enough. It's not on page one of New York Times. Nobody cares. So it's fine. You know, we have a narrative that works for us, and we can live with it, and we don't have to worry about it. The problem is that we didn't win the war, and we didn't arrive at a peace either. And we're just leaving, and it has done tremendous damage to our global standing. The other big problem is that, in a sense, the president never really dealt with the Iraq overhang. Dealing with the Iraq overhang by a Democratic president would have required them to put the diplomats in charge. You see, our foreign policy to this day is driven by generals and Pentagon and the CIA. And we've lost that sense that, you know, foreign policy is managed by diplomats and statesmen, and you carry a big stick, a big military stick, in order to facilitate diplomacy. I remember when General Petraeus used to refer to Ambassador Holbrook affectionately as my wingman. Ambassador Holbrooke used to say that, you know, I don't know since when diplomats have become generals as wingmen. I mean, clearly in his memory in the Balkans, it was General Clark who was Holbrooke's wingman. His job was to get Milosevic's attention. His job was not to finish the Bosnian crisis. That was the job of the diplomats. And, you know, this issue is still hanging over Syria today. When, you know, when we debate what we can do, it's either an all-in, heavy footprint military intervention or nothing. There is no role for American diplomacy here. We don't even have a special envoy, high-level envoy assigned to this. And when you market it that way, that it's either $100 billion a year adventure or we shouldn't do anything, it's very easy to say we shouldn't do anything. After Afghanistan, I think, and the way that it was dealt with, we, the administration also followed another big assumption, and that is that the Middle East doesn't matter or should not matter to global politics, that it should be downgraded, and we should focus on Asia, this whole idea of pivoting to Asia. You know, the president recently told the New Republic magazine that how do I square off tens of thousands of people dying in Syria with tens of thousands of people dying in the Congo. By which he meant that, you know, Syria is no different than the Congo and the Middle East is no more important than Central Africa, however you want to interpret that. But in other words, there's no particular strategic issue here. And there's getting involved in Syria or getting involved with the Arab Spring would mean that the Middle East matters more than the administration would like it to matter. If you look at our engagement with the Middle East the past 2 years, since the Arab Spring, it has been fairly minimal. If you look at the way we engaged any other major democratization movement in the first 2 years of that event, what we did, how we created global leadership to give it direction, to address its problems, you see a very marked difference. Take the economic sphere. You know, when Eastern Europe went democratic, over a 10-year period between 1989 and 1999, the international community put in over $100 billion into Eastern Europe, and that's dollars of that time period. When Mexico went democratic, in one swoop, the Treasury, Goldman Sachs and IMF put $40 billion into the Mexican economy as a grand bargain for massive economic reform. It's easy to say that, you know, the Arabs cannot find their way to democracy. And, you know, the trouble is on the ground. And that, the, you know, the East Europeans really wanted to be part of Europe. And, you know, the Mexicans really wanted to be part of NAFTA. There's a lot of pull factors. That's true. But there was a big push factor, too. There's not a single one of these areas of the world that has become democratic without embracing market economic reforms and integrating into the global economy. So we spend $1 trillion trying to force the Middle East to become democratic. Now that they're going democratic, the administration's message is, we don't care, you're on your own, and there's no help there. So take the case of Egypt. It's a country of 80 million, the most important in the Arab world. Probably the future of that region will depend on where Egypt goes. Today, there are 1 million more Egyptians that are unemployed compared to 2009. Every economic statistics about Egypt is negative. Its GDP has shrunk over the past 2 years steadily. And for Egypt to get out of where it is, it has to be growing at 10% a year for over a decade. And there is no growth in that economy. There won't be there without a major transformation. And there is no international support for Egypt. I mean, forget about the size of support that Europe is giving and IMF is giving to Greece. There's nothing there. The group of G8 countries made a commitment to create an Arab Spring economic assistance fund. They committed $9 billion to it for, 20 countries. Since 2009, only $116 million has been put in that fund. So, we complain about why Egyptians don't do IMF reforms. No country has done IMF reforms without a broader economic support. So it's an opportunity lost. The past 2 years, the Arab Spring has lost its momentum. Critical reforms have not happened. And we're in a worse place than we were before. And Syria, in a different way, is a very dangerous neglect by the United States. It's a country that is going to impact the entire region. First of all, there are now over 1 million refugees that have left Syria. By State Department estimates, the number will be 3 million by the end of 2013. 1 million in Jordan, 1 million in Lebanon, 1 million in Turkey. In Lebanon and Jordan, that number would approximate 20 to 25% of the population of those countries. Those countries, everything else aside, don't have the economic wherewithal of actually supporting the refugees. If you looked at international assistance to the refugees, it's close to zero. There's not really massive amount of support going. There's no sort of a global drive, which again requires American leadership, of raising substantial amount of money that would be able to support the refugees. Large parts of Syria are becoming Al-Qaeda land. The state institutions have withered away. Extremists and Al-Qaeda have taken over. And the key question is that this did not need to happen. Had the United States provided weaponry to a lot of the opposition, they would not have got their weapons from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda grew in Syria because it became the main source of supply for weapons early on. But clearly, we can't tolerate that. I mean, the president put a very high bar that only if it's proven that Syria has used chemical weapons, we're going to get involved. But the reality is that we do have vested interest in Syria, which is denying territory next to Israel, next to Jordan, next to Turkey to an Al-Qaeda entity. And then the sectarian conflict that is happening in Syria between the Alawites and the Sunnis is going to have its mirror in Iraq, in Lebanon, in the Persian Gulf, and it's going to impact the entire region. And the United States has interest in all of these. This is not just a humanitarian tragedy that we could ignore. But again, neglecting Syria has made the problem much bigger. When you leave the United States, when you leave Washington, you go to the Middle East, the message in there is very clear, that the United States is washing its hands off this region. And it doesn't want to have anything to do with it. It doesn't want to lead there. And it doesn't want to be involved in its crises. And it doesn't see things happening in the Middle East, for the better or for the worse, as really relevant or relevant enough to do something about it. So the question is, where is the United States going? Supposedly it's going to Asia. There is a problem with the way we've conceived of a pivot, because the pivot, the terminology even works, is that you pivot towards something and you pivot away from something. So we're pivoting away from Europe and the Middle East, and we're pivoting to Asia, and we want to sort of be a big economic player there and contain China in Asia. Well, first of all, the world is interconnected. I heard it from an Asian foreign minister. He said, doesn't matter what the United States says about its newfound interest in Asia, the most important thing for us is whether the United States is willing to draw a red line in Syria and enforce it. If it's not willing to do that, then it's not really trustworthy for us. If it's going to treat a region that it's been so invested in this manner of washing its hands overnight, if it's going to be abandoning its allies, that's not a right message here. To that you can add that if we lay a red line about Syria's use of chemical weapons and keep moving that red line and don't want to enforce it, there are other countries that have red lines before them, North Korea, Iran. They also are watching. What we're saying in Syria, very loud and clear, is too difficult, it's too big, it's too messy. We don't want to do it. Well, North Korea is even messier than Syria. And Iran is messier than both of them put together. And you don't have any credibility in your foreign policy because people don't look at what you say about them. They look at how you act elsewhere. So we can't have an Asia policy without having a proper Middle East policy. It's just the way it is. We can't just all of a sudden decide that, you know, 10 years of deep involvement with the Middle East didn't happen. And we could just ignore that region. But also, the other part of the problem with pivot to Asia is that we often understand Asia just to be Asia-Pacific. In American minds, in policymaking minds, is the area between Burma and Japan. In Chinese minds, the country that, you know, we want to contain, Asia means Asia. It means everything from the Mediterranean to the Sea of Japan. The Chinese don't refer to Middle East as Middle East. They refer to it as West Asia. And they're moving there. They're moving there in a big way. The industrial and population centers of China are moving west. That's making Central Asian energy supplies much more important. Even Persian Gulf energy supplies on which China is relying increasingly will not go through the Straits of Malacca, could go through port facilities in Pakistan and pipelines going through Burma. The Chinese, if you look at their pattern of investment, are investing in railways, pipelines, roads that are connecting Turkey to Iran, to Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan all the way to port facilities in Pakistan. They're developing markets. They're looking at 300 million population of the Middle East as a potential market. If you went to northern Iraq today, one of the most sought-after skill sets is Mandarin-speaking lawyers, because there's so much Chinese business happening there. So, you know, as we're pivoting east, they're pivoting west. And as we're trying to say the Middle East matters less, for them, for China, Middle East is a rising strategic interest in the East. And their approach to the Middle East is very much like their approach to Africa, investing for the long run in a deep relationship with economic and political. So if our game is really matching China, containing China, having a global presence that contends with China's return to global economic prominence, it doesn't make sense to be focused on only one area, which is China's current power play, which is the South China Sea and East Asia, and then abandon a territory which we have been traditionally very strong in, and China is actually moving into. So, you know, all of these things to me suggest are sort of indications that our foreign policy, the way we've conducted, the way we've interpreted domestically, is not being interpreted internationally outside of the United States in the manner that would actually serve our interest. Our assumptions are faulty. The zigzag manner in which we've dealt with Afghanistan, the reluctance we're showing with Syria, the abandonment of the Middle East, they not only are undermining our global standing and the credibility of our foreign policy, but actually are exposing us to dangers that ultimately we will have to contend with at a very heavy price. So let me stop there and I'll be very happy to answer any questions.
My thanks to Dr. Vali Nasser, Dean of the Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University and author of the new book, The Dispensable Nation, America's Foreign Policy in Retreat. So now it's time for some audience questions. We have a large number. We can't possibly review all of them, but they cluster around a number of key countries and points. There are actually not too many questions on Afghanistan, sort of reflective of your comment that Americans seem to want to sort of forget about it. But one member of our audience notes that he or she worked in Afghanistan, spent some time there, and felt wherever they went, they felt the Taliban was hated, and yet the Taliban seems to have a lot of clout. What explains this? Should we negotiate with them? What is the role of the Taliban as the U.S. Withdraws from the Afghan Taliban, as the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan itself?
Well, I think the Taliban still have a lot of capability, and they're playing a waiting game. I think everybody in the region is playing a waiting game for 2014, after which they're going to pursue their interests. The Taliban will probably try to will revive their military campaign after we're gone, or our forces have really become too small to resist them in many places. They will lay claim to large parts of eastern and southern Afghanistan, the sort of areas that border Pakistan. They will continue to get support and refuge in Pakistan, and they will become a bigger player in Afghanistan. So our aim of denying them a presence and political control and military control over large parts of the country is not likely to hold. The only question is, how far would they go? Would they once again want to control Kabul, or whether they would be happy with a situation similar to Hezbollah in Lebanon? You know, you control large areas of the country. You also have a presence in a fig leaf government in Kabul and in the parliament and in the cabinet. So technically, Afghanistan has a government that is acceptable to the international community. But for all practical purposes, the Taliban will be running large parts of the territory. We don't know at that point in time what kind of a relationship they may have with Al-Qaeda. You know, these are the kinds of things that you would have got in a negotiation. You would have given them some turf, but you would have got certain commitments. And you would have satisfied some of Pakistan's concerns in Afghanistan, so they would have had a vested interest in backing that deal. But even if there is a possibility, let me just say, if there is a possibility of a deal between the Taliban and the Karzai government, it's really going to be negotiated by Iran and Pakistan. It's really up to those to come to some kind of a term as to how they're going to divide Afghanistan between them.
Well, that's interesting, because there are some questions about whether the United States should focus more on diplomatic efforts with both Pakistan and Iran that could facilitate a better future for Afghanistan.
It should have, but we don't have any leverage anymore. You see, your most leverage in playing that role is when you actually had your troops on the ground. And actually the best leverage, and Richard Hallberg always used to say, is instead of surging, you would have threatened to surge. And that potentiality of American coming in would have been the biggest incentive for them to do that. But, you know, from Pakistan's point of view, they've gone through radical surgery, if you would. They've gone through all the pain with us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's very little incentive for them to concede much. And as a result, you know, we're leaving. And the problem is this, is that, you know, the two military forces in Afghanistan were the Taliban and the United States. A negotiation would really have been about ceasefire. And from the Taliban point of view, what is it that will get the United States to leave? And from Pakistan's view is, what should we give them to go home? And from the Chinese view and Iranian view, the same thing. Now we're going home for free. So, you know, they really don't have to give us anything. And therefore, it's going to be very difficult for us to play that role.
All right. Shifting to a different country, Syria, there are large number of questions about U.S.-Syria policy, including do you recommend U.S. military intervention in Syria? And what can be and should be done about the chemical weapons stockpiles in Syria, and whether there is any effective U.S. strategy in Syria short of military action?
Well, I don't think we have a serious strategy. Let me just say that. I mean, there is no clear sense of how we're going to be dealing with Syria. What is the end game we want to see and how the United States is going to do that. Largely, our approach has been that others have to figure it out, and when they figure it out, we may decide to support them or not. Now, the chemical weapons issue is a red line that we drew. We have to enforce it because it's not about Syria at all anymore. This is about North Korea. It's about Iran. It's about American credibility. If you lay down a marker and don't enforce it, then why would anybody take your markers seriously anymore? So that's really about America's global position. I think yesterday the president actually moved the marker further up. So he basically said that the evidence has to be approved by the international community, not by the CIA, really, which means that the Security Council has to, all five of them has to say, we vouchsafe for this information. That's not going to happen, which basically, it's almost like saying it will never be verified whether he used it or not. And that, you know, if you're in Iran and their red line is they're going to build a bomb, how are we going to deal with the evidence of whether they have built a bomb or not? If it's going to be the same standard. If it's proven that they did, there are ways of showing teeth. You could, you know, hit a number of targets in Syria like with cruise missiles, like we did in the Sudan or previously did in with camps in southern Afghanistan after the attacks on American embassies in East Africa, in a way of showing that, you know, there is consequences to this, and you better not do it because the next consequence will be bigger. Now, I don't believe we should get militarily involved. I think there is a lot of things we can do short of that. As I said, we can take leadership on the civilian, humanitarian, and diplomatic side of this. The president should appoint a senior envoy empowered by him directly who's in charge of creating order in the international community around this, who would revive the diplomatic track, who would galvanize the international community around supporting the refugees. And I think the region right now, everybody's operating on the assumption that we don't care and we don't have a strategy. I think even the symbolism of American seriousness will change everybody's calculations. And I do think that we should impose a no-fly zone in collaboration with other NATO allies, not only because the butchery in Syria is not okay, but also because it's important to keep the refugees in their own country. That protects the other countries from the impact. And thirdly, I do think we should be arming the rebels. I mean, it was leaked to the New York Times that the Secretary of State Clinton and the head of CIA, General Petraeus, had come up with a plan to vet and arm certain rebel groups. And I would tell you there are two reasons why we should do this. We learned from Afghanistan, we should have learned from Afghanistan. That's not this Afghanistan, the previous escapade there. It's better that we arm them than let others arm them. It would have been better for the United States to arm the Mujahideen and create direct contacts and knowledge and relationships between the CIA and the Afghan fighters, then let Saudi Arabia and Pakistan do it. We know where that led. We're allowing others fund and arm these people, and that's not a good idea. And finally, if we're not going to go in and clean out Al-Qaeda, one of these militias will have to do it. And you better start arming them and training them to do that.
Okay, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Dr. Vali Nasser, Dean of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, who is discussing how to improve America's Middle East policy. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. Maybe it's more about the future than the past. The questioner asks, what exactly was Secretary Clinton's influence in all of these policy developments and issues?
Well, Secretary Clinton, from the very beginning, her job was to raise the profile of the State Department after it was battered during the Bush period because of the tensions between the Pentagon and the State Department. So both internationally it was important for the countries around the world to take the State Department seriously, And internally, it was important to put the State Department back on the map on policymaking. And I think she was probably the best person to do that because of her political stature and international standing. And she has her fingerprints on a lot of distinct policy arenas, from Libya to Pakistan to China on South China Sea issues. But as I argue in the book, the White House's policymaking structure was designed in a way to provide the president with only a certain set of options that would fit the domestic agenda and would fit his thinking on the way we ought to conduct foreign policy. So it's not a question of... So the problem is structural. I don't think it's going to change with Secretary Kerry being there. I think Secretary Clinton had a very good relationship with the president, was quite influential. But end of the day, this shouldn't happen through ad hoc personal relationship. The policy-making apparatus should be set up in a way that the diplomats make diplomatic strategy, the military makes military strategy, and the president has clear options from among them to choose what he wants to do. So the secretary talked to the president about the diplomatic option in Afghanistan, but the important thing was that it was not formally on the table. And it's the White House that decides, end of the day, what formal options are put before the president to debate.
Fortunately, we have more time than I had thought. So we could go back to some of the other great questions that I wasn't sure we'd have time to address. There are quite a few questions about U.S. policy in Iran, including whether U.S. use of force is going to be necessary to deal with the Iranian nuclear program, whether the upcoming presidential elections in Iran will be a new opportunity to improve U.S.-Iranian relations. Can you give us a sort of thumbnail summary of where you think U.S. policy ought to go with respect to Iran, especially in the security area?
Well, if we don't want to get involved in Syria, and don't want to have a big footprint in the Middle East, it's not clear why exactly we would get ourselves entangled militarily with Iran. That's definitely going to keep us very busy singularly in the Middle East for a long time to come. And I think they know it very well. The countries around Iran know it very well, that the military option is off the table. It doesn't matter what you say, as that Asian foreign minister said. It matters what you do. Now, the problem is that, on the other side, I don't think the United States is serious about negotiations with Iran. So it doesn't matter who's the Iranian president. And it's at some level, as we've seen with President Obama, it doesn't matter who's the American president. The Obama administration basically adopted the Bush administration's Iran policy, lock, stock, and barrel, and then improved it. So what was the Bush administration policy? All options are on the table, which is sort of this veiled threat. But we adopted what we called a two-track policy. Track one is economic pressure, sanctions. The Bush administration could not get Russians and the Chinese and the Europeans to go along. The Obama administration did. So what's the purpose of economic sanctions? It's to get the Iranians to the table to talk. So track one facilitates track two. The problem is that we've become pretty good at track one, but we're not really doing track two. So track two requires that And the Iranians are difficult. They don't want to give things up. They're kind of like the North Vietnamese when we were negotiating with them. Trenchant, intractable, you know, obdurate, difficult to manage. It may take a very long time to take, you know, two steps forward, and then, you know, you're going to take three steps back. All of that is very true. But when you go to negotiations and you have a clear set of things you want, suspend your enrichment above 5%. Hand over all the 20% enriched uranium you have. Send it out of the country. Sign the additional protocol to IAEA. Open your secret military site. So we have a very clear list. So like in any negotiations, those of you are in a business negotiation, the other side is going to say, okay, what's on the table? And you've all read New York Times, you know, the reports of the past four meetings we've had with Iranians. What was on the table? There isn't anything on the table other than aircraft parts. That's not a serious negotiating position. Now, why isn't anything on the table? Because domestically, politically, it's costly for an American president to actually engage in serious negotiations with Iran. Because he has to answer to the Republicans. It may take too long. It requires you to spend political capital. Everybody is for a silver bullet negotiations. We schedule a meeting, we go in, we come out with a signed document. In real world, it doesn't happen that way. We don't know what might happen. You know, the Oslo peace process was a fantastic story for 10 years until it wasn't. You don't know. So, but it requires risk. It requires, you know, Rabin was willing to take a risk at that point in time, which means that he had to go to the public and say, trust me. I know these guys are terrorists. I know there's blood there, but you got to trust me. I'm going to negotiate. I'm going to give something. I'm going to get something in return. And that requires political cost. You're not going to get anywhere with Iran if there is no real negotiations. And real negotiation starts when there's something real on the table. So it would be they're hurting under sanctions. So what specific sanctions would they get if they suspended that 5%? And they've asked this question in meetings. And the answer has been, we have nothing to offer. Which is, if we suspend that 5%, would the Europeans lift the oil embargo, for instance? Something concrete for something concrete. So I think actually we're in sort of a dark period with Iran because they're not likely to surrender. There's no upside to surrendering. So if that's our idea that, you know, somewhere along the line just throw in the towel, didn't happen with Saddam, it's not going to happen with them either. So we're not going to go to war and we're not going to negotiate. So I think there's a likelihood that, you know, the next 4 years will be pretty much a reiteration of the past 4 years. I mean, the story again with Iran, the narrative sounds good domestically, but it's not a realistic path to solving this crisis. So we say, so we're going to end up in a place of containing Iran, which is, you know, they keep building centrifuges and then they're going to pass the point of no return. And then our relationship in that, it's going to look like North Korea at some point.
You commented earlier about the linkages between U.S. policy in the Middle East and U.S. policy in Asia. If your diagnosis and analysis is correct, that the U.S. policy is in retreat, that we're not likely to live up to our red line statement in Syria, we're not likely to prevent an Iranian nuclear program, but to contain it, all of which are differences from what the president has said, how, and we have a continuing problem with North Korea, how will this affect our allies in East Asia? In this most recent period where Kim Jong-un has saber-rattled, you have for the first time in many years parliamentarians in Japan and Seoul calling for independent nuclear capabilities of their nuclear weapons capabilities of their own. So is one of the consequences of this failure to lead an unraveling of some of America's closest alliances?
I think so. First of all, the president made non-proliferation a very big priority, and there was a huge nuclear summit he held in the United States. He raised this issue. So countries, you would either they look at U.S. commitment to Europe, the nuclear umbrella, and they say that you can trust in American policy, you don't need to have nuclear weapons, the United States will defend you, or you come to the conclusion that, you know, that may not happen and that the U.S. is no longer committed to that kind of a role, in which case then you have to create your own deterrence. And that's where, you know, South Koreans and the Japanese are beginning to debate as to whether they ought to do that. But also I think you know, there is a discrepancy with our desire right now to even further tighten alliances in Asia against China, and the fact that actually our posture does not give people the comfort that they should embrace this. Because we're asking Asian countries not to form an alliance against North Korea, but really form an alliance against China, which is a much more dangerous and risky thing for them to do. And it requires actually great deal of confidence in that America would stay with its strategy. And that's the problem, that we're not conveying that message.
There are several questioners who would like to hear your views about the role of the Arab League in this part of the world, in the Middle East and Persian Gulf. I mean, can the Arab League really help resolve things in Syria? What is the relationship between the United States and the Arab League? If the Arab League supports a new proposal in Palestinian-Israeli relations, is that a positive step? Can you enlighten us about the role of the Arab League in all of these conflict situations?
Well, the Arab League, it's kind of like a United Nations General Assembly, and it doesn't. It's not like a Security Council. It does not have the power to pass resolutions that would become almost international law and require enforcement. It does have a legitimating role. So we saw that in Libya, that if Arab League lent its support to NATO intervention, this made it okay. This was no longer in the localized, some kind of colonial encroachment. It now was an invitation by the collectivity of the Arab world for outside intervention. If American leadership was there in the Middle East, it's possible that Arab League can gradually become, if you would, a vehicle or a basis for a region-wide alliance system, something a lot more like either NATO or ASEAN, where it would be more than just a sort of a periodic meeting of Arab leaders, that it would be able to take more things on board. But the problem is that in the Arab world, there is no one leader to play that role. So Egypt is the biggest one, but it's weak. Saudi Arabia has a lot of money, but it has no military power. And the biggest money is now in the hand of the weakest country, which is Qatar. And even within the Arab League, there is a lot of now rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Qatar over which direction the policy goes. It does require some degree of outside support. On the Arab-Israeli issue, yes, it does provide certain legitimating factor, but it would only be effective if one of these countries would be willing to take a major lead using that resolution to step forward and do something bold, and that remains to be seen.
Both President Bush and President Obama have said many times that the United States is not at war with Islam. We're at war with Islamic extremists, and we're at war with we object very much to some tyrannical regimes who are killing their own people. But thinking more broadly, and you have a very special perspective on this, what can the U.S. do to improve its relations with the Islamic world?
Well, at this point in time, I think after President Obama came in, there was a period of gradual repair. But, things don't turn overnight. I saw this firsthand in Pakistan. After 2 decades of chilly relations, things are not going to change overnight. It requires you to spend time and gradually build up relations. But the biggest problem now is that our primary mode of engagement with the Middle East in particular is drones. This is still war on terror. It's not a war on Islam. The language is better. But ultimately, there is no economic support. There is no real political engagement. There is no real effort by the United States to address issues that affects daily lives of people there. We're not engaged except when it comes to counterterrorism. And it's very clear that, our policy in the Middle East is driven more by the CIA than it is by traditional wings of our foreign policy. And if you're at the receiving end of this, so I saw this firsthand in Pakistan. They say, you say you give us aid. You don't. You give us $2 billion a year, two-thirds of which is military aid, and two-thirds of that is really subsidy to your own arms manufacturers. They said out of every dollar you give for civilian aid, 90 cents is spent in Washington on varieties of NGOs and consulting firms, etc. So, you know, there's no money that you really give us. And this is a very transactional relationship. You only give money for services that is for you, military services. You give money to use, to be able to drone, and you give money to have these roads open so you can supply Afghanistan. But there is nothing else there. So people are angry because they look at drone attacks as basically daily aerial bombardments. They think their borders are violated by a foreign country's aircraft. The fact that it doesn't have a pilot is immaterial to them. So either their government is in on this, which is one problem, or their government doesn't know and can't defend its borders, which is another problem. But there is no countervailing effect here, and I describe this in the book. You know, Holbrooke's idea was that, you know, this works a lot better if there is something you're doing there that affects the daily lives of people. So, you know, Pakistan has massive electricity shortages of some places up to 18 hours a day. Are we doing anything with that? Are we investing? Can we go there and say, you know, we invested in this power plant, and that power plant has reduced electricity shortage by 4 weeks, and whether that actually creates greater tolerance for the fact that we want to use drones. So from their perspective, you know, we have only one interest and one engagement, and the same is true of Yemen. And as Al-Qaeda proliferates, the sense is that, you know, that this is the main mode of engagement, and this is not going to go down well. I mean, ultimately, at some point, I think the drone strategy is not tenable because politically, the countries on the region will not be able to allow it and sustain it. Public opinion is too raw about this, and there's no countervailing measures to at least lessen the pain.
We've hardly discussed at all the venerable issue of the region, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And at some point in the U.S. debate, it was said that if we could help solve that problem, a lot of these other problems can be resolved. Later on, we flipped and said if we can solve a lot of the other problems, we could solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem. What exactly is the relationship of the Israeli-Palestinian problem to all these other issues? And do you have any thoughts about how to improve that situation?
Well, that's not an easy problem to solve. Part of it is really domestic American politics. That's the reality of it. You know, there's very strong opinions about this issue in the United States in important constituencies. It's the only issue that showed up, if you would, in a major way during the presidential campaign. So this is an important issue domestically in the U.S. As a result, it's difficult. But I personally don't think it's an important issue now. I mean, if you ask the Arabs, it's always an important issue. It's kind of like a blue flame in the region. It's been there before. It's been there now. It's going to be there. It's a sore point, and the anger at this issue is real. But resolving it requires, you know, some major concessions by both sides, which is not going to happen with a lot of arm twisting and serious engagement by the United States, and I don't see that right now happening. But it's not the issue right now. So the issue, the future of the Middle East is being written in Egypt and in Syria, not in Palestine. And I think, you know, when the president went to the region recently and focused on this issue rather than Syria and Egypt, he really was not saying that we're getting engaged in the Middle East. He was saying we're not getting engaged in the Middle East, because he was not addressing the most important issue. So ultimately, we have to deal with this. We have to be engaged in it. But again, it goes to the fact that we have to, any American president who does this has to be willing to spend the political capital, the time, the energy to move the ball forward. And I don't see that right now in the cards.
One of our questioners notes that in one of your books, Forces of Fortune, you speak of an upwardly mobile middle class that could potentially wipe away extremist tendencies in a number of these countries. Maybe we're looking at the wrong place. We're looking at Washington policy. It should be the evolution of social mobility and movements in a number of these countries.
Well, if you looked at the Arab Spring, it's not a coincidence it happened in Tunisia, the country with the largest middle class integrated into European community and also the most literate Arab country. The Arab Spring, you know, it's true that the fruit seller set himself on fire in Tunisia, but that would have been a tree falling in the middle of the forest if it wasn't for the rich, employed, educated, upwardly mobile youth of Tunisia who Facebooked and tweeted this. And then it's not a surprise that in Egypt, the face of the Tahrir movement was a young executive from Google. So again, you know, who were the kids who went to Tahrir Square? They were middle-class kids. This was a middle-class revolution. It happened in these two countries because these were the first two Arab countries that started economic reform. And that's why, as I said, it was so important for us to expand and entrench that private sector-driven middle class by helping economic reform. Now, the Middle East has a lot of middle class. It is not empowered and it's not integrated into the global economy, largely because it's sitting behind protected, economic systems. And ultimately, you know, we cannot change the region's religion. We cannot change its political system. But we should know European history. That in European history, religious moderation came because of trade and commerce. Luther was not a moderate, nor was Calvin. It sounded like the Taliban if you look at the way they ruled Geneva. It was David Hume. It's David Hume, Scotland. It's the Industrial Revolution that mattered. You look at the history of the West, democracy flourished among the middle class. So it's not about reforming Islam. It's about whether you create a middle class that will do to the Middle East what the middle class in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia has done to the economies and politics of those societies.
We're just about out of time. We only have time for one more question, and I just ask you for a brief response to a very difficult one. Overall, if you could sort of project into the future, what will be President Obama's legacy for this region?
Well, it's not done yet, but...
Well, you're projecting forward.
Well, if the current trends continue, I think it will be negative. I think the perception right now is very negative about the administration. That it is abandoning the region. It hasn't lived up to its promises. And at the most critical historical moment in this region, which is the Arab Spring, and particularly Syria, that it basically washed its hands off the region. So, you know, the Bush administration was guilty of the sin of overreach. The Obama administration is going to be guilty of the sin of neglect and not reaching enough. And I think ultimately historians will look at whether the United States, whether this was a wasted opportunity, the first 2-3 years of the Arab Spring, that we could have made a difference, and we didn't, and we would pay the price for it.
And just an important footnote. Is the untimely death of Richard Holbrooke a factor in this retreat?
Well, it was in the Afghanistan policy arena. I mean, the administration, as I detail in the book, did its best for him not to be hurt. And also much of the bruising he got was because he would insist on pushing policy and ideas. But I think particularly in the Afghanistan-Pakistan arena, his death did make a difference. Because those policy areas, I think, collapsed after he went. Particularly with Pakistan, it was very evident. And I've been told, this is not my sayings, I've been told by people in the administration that never before has the death of a single person made such a big policy impact.
Well, our thanks to Dr. Vali Nasser, Dean of the Paul Nitzer School.
Thank you.
Of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins and author of the new book, The Dispensable Nation, America's Foreign Policy in Retreat. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East and Asia Pacific forums. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Dean Nasser's new book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign them in this room following the program. I'm Michael Nacht, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you very much.